Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's lecture is titled, Being British, Feeling Muslim. Speaking will be Farhan Nizami, Director of the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, Prince of Wales Fellow in the Study of the Islamic World, Magdalen College, Oxford. Our opening remarks are by Augustus Richard Norton, Professor of International Relations and Anthropology at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Services Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
The evening's event, entitled Muslims in Europe, is co-sponsored by a new European Studies Program at Boston University, and partially by European Commission and by Humanities Foundation at Boston University. The Institute for Human Sciences is a forum for new nonpartisan debates, research, and also education in the matters of international relations. This conference aims to contribute to the debate on Muslims and Islam in European public sphere. There are more than 10 million Muslims in Western Europe, and they have recently received unprecedented global attention. This attention has often been accompanied by inadequate and simplified approaches, and that makes our conference important and, I hope, useful. We'll address the diverse ethnic, religious, and generational identities among Muslims, and we'll explore the different ways in which Muslims are adapting and integrating as well as resisting to their European settings. Today's conference is planned as the first in a series, since the issues we'll be talking about need our continuous attention. With these few words, my role ends for the moment. The real program is going to be introduced by Professor Augustus Richard Norton, the Professor of International Relations and Anthropology at Boston University. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. This may be the first of a series of meetings focusing on Muslims in the West, so it is my pleasure to welcome you to what I hope will only be the inaugural for a series of timely and perhaps important meetings. I'd like to acknowledge with gratitude the sponsorship of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University and also the program in European Studies at Boston University. As well. And I would be remiss if I did not also thank Boston University's own Humanities Foundation, which has assisted us with important funding as well. Muslims in Europe is our overarching theme this afternoon, but notwithstanding the successes of European unification, the experience of Muslims in Europe is very much a collection of national cases, each shaped importantly by the particularities of history, the details of public policy, the coincidences of leadership, good, bad, and indifferent, and the cultural repertoire of particular Muslim communities. Muslims in Europe sometimes reflect recent migration, as you know, but some communities, as in the Balkans, of course, justly point to centuries of European heritage. Our keynote speaker this afternoon is amply qualified to address a variety of these timely topics, but this afternoon he will begin by focusing on one case, and that is to say, Muslims in Britain. Being British, Feeling Muslim is the name of his talk. Farhan Nizami is the founder director of the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, which has become a premier forum as well as a lively research center. He is the Prince of Wales Fellow in the Study of the Islamic World at Magdalen College, Oxford University. For his DPhil, he read modern history at Wadham College, Oxford University, and at the Center for Advanced Study in History, Aligarh Muslim University. From 1983, he was a fellow of St. Cross College, Oxford. He's also Rotman's fellow in Muslim history. He was also Rotman's fellow in Muslim history and subsequently a fellow in Islamic studies. He's an emeritus fellow of St. Cross College and a member of the faculties of modern history and Oriental studies at the University of Oxford. Among his other claims to fame and his very distinguished biography is that he is the series editor of the Makers of Islamic Civilization series published by Oxford University Press beginning in 2004, and he's the founder director of the Journal of Islamic Studies. He specializes in his own academic work in Muslim social and intellectual history. He is also a member of many very distinguished and highly respected boards, advisory committees, and so on. Just to name a couple, he is the chairman of the Academic Council of Wilton Park, an important conference site, as you know, in Britain. And he is also a member of the steering committee of the World Economic Forum in Davos. He's a man of immense talent, immense experience, and great intelligence. And I hope you'll join me in welcoming Farhan Nizami, our keynote speaker. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Norton. After such a generous introduction, it's always with trepidation that one comes to the podium. I'm very pleased to be here and very grateful to the Institute for Human Sciences and to the European Studies Initiative at Boston and to Professor Norton for this invitation. Yes, the title that I had suggested was Being British, Feeling Muslim. Or alternatively, perhaps it might have been better to have suggested something like religious identity and citizenship, some reflections from a Muslim perspective. It is, in fact, as the director earlier mentioned, that it is arising from recent events that there is an ongoing debate in the West, often aired in the public media, about the potential conflict within the hearts and minds of a particular group of citizens, i.e. the Muslims. This debate in the United Kingdom has the catchy label, being British, feeling Muslim. And as Britain is not the only country in Europe or the Western world which hosts a significant Muslim minority, this topic has a wider resonance. It may indeed be of interest to people in the United States here as well, because it raises the question whether committed Muslims can be loyal to the nation states in which they live, especially if they, that is the Muslims, are a minority. More widely still, the topic touches on the idea that feeling Muslim is somehow uncomfortable, even incompatible with being a citizen in a modern nation state. It was, I think, late in 2001, after the tragic events of 9/11, speaking at an event organized by my center, that the Prince of Wales spoke thus. The links between the Islamic and Western worlds matter more today than ever before, because the degree of misunderstanding between them remains dangerously high, and because the need for the two to live and work together in an increasingly interdependent world has never been greater. He went on to acknowledge, we shall need to work harder to understand each other, to drain any poison between us, and to lay the ghost of suspicion and fear. So let me first, from the vantage point of a Muslim who has enjoyed living in Britain and teaching at Oxford for nearly two decades, try to identify some of those areas where the poison of suspicion and fear still exists, to consider the dilemmas this creates for Muslims and to suggest how Muslims and the host communities might begin to contribute to the resolution and remedy of the situation. I shall not attempt to give you an historical overview of Muslim presence in Britain, which some claim goes back to the time of King Offa in the 8th century. For that matter, I shall not burden you with estimates of the number of Muslims in Britain, anywhere up to 2.5 million. I shall not recount the sacrifices made by Muslims for the Allied cause during the First and the Second World Wars, difficulties and challenges experienced by Muslims in the field of education or employment are not my subject. Limitations of the Race Relations Act, underrepresentation of Muslims in the police and prison service, judiciary, army, media, or public life, parliament and provincial assemblies will not be covered. Neither do I intend to enter into the narrower debate about Muslim single faith schools. These are all clearly questions of great importance. But this afternoon, I would like to go beyond them at issues of historical memory, the image of the self and the other, the evolution of nationhood and citizenship, and how Muslim presence in modern Britain should inform and modify our understanding of these important concepts. Is the concept of Britishness coterminous with that of Englishness? Why has successive government legislation on education or anti-discrimination not been strong enough in addressing Muslim concerns? Why is it that career success of Muslim doctors, entrepreneurs, etc., does not always translate into concomitant power and influence in society at large? Why, despite the fact that nearly 83% Muslims have registered to vote, does the number of Muslim candidates and elected representatives at local, regional, and national levels remain small, almost negligible? So let us look first of all at the popular perception of Islam and Muslims in Britain and Europe more generally. It is unfortunate that in the West, Islam has been seen less as a path to human salvation and more as an aggressive political ideology, posing both a challenge and a threat. Shorn of its religious and spiritual moorings, it is not surprising that the image of Islam that emerges is a distorted and unattractive one. It is easily forgotten that Islam calls upon its followers to exercise moderation and to reject and oppose all kinds of extremism, zealotry, and bigotry. If a Muslim in Britain is to live in accordance with the requirements of his faith, it is inevitable that he will admire and seek to support and be of service to those values and institutions that are consistent with Islam and merit respect. I should also add that he will be critical of and will challenge several of the values and assumptions of a society in which he lives. Some of the dilemmas of British Muslims, however, spring from the knowledge that any criticism they may make are likely to be misinterpreted by a predominantly secular society as an unwelcome and alien intrusion rather than a genuine desire to contribute to and improve the society of which they are part. Similar criticism made by British Christians might also be unwelcome, but would be much less likely to be misinterpreted. In Britain, over 50 years ago, Archbishop William Temple argued that Christians were likely to be attacked from all sides if they do their duty. If they are faithful to their commission, they would ignore such complaints and continue as far as they can to influence all citizens and permeate all parties. Within British society, it may be acceptable for the Archbishop of Canterbury to pose such a challenge to the established system. Sadly, it would be quite a different matter for a Muslim to do so at the present time. One basic reason for such a response at the present time is the distorted perception of the nature of Islam in the West more generally. The earliest European views of Islam were formed on the basis of ignorance or fear of a perceived political threat. In the Age of Enlightenment, when some of the stereotypes began to change, Islam was used as a potent weapon in internecine Christian debates. But even then, the views expressed, say, by Voltaire, Montesquieu, and others were such that they would shock most contemporary scholars. In fact, it was the Oxford historian Richard Southern who pointed out that a better understanding of Islam in the West could get no help from antiquity and no comfort from the present. This is particularly true today. Stock images have always been used to convey Islam to Western audience, and now the media and television in particular has trivialized this to a remarkable degree. While in the 18th and 19th century, Romantic painters used a minaret under a crescent moon or the palm-studded desert to depict the Orient, contemporary images are those of the actions of terrorists, the turbaned sternness of the mullah, and of course the veiled woman. Media coverage is generally not of Islam as a religion, but of Muslim-related events. And most of the snapshots perpetuate the image of Islam being outside the modern world, or indeed as an ever-present violent menace at the walls. It is not surprising, therefore, that this constant portrayal of Islam as violently aggressive encourages the perception of Muslims within the wider society as alien and potential adversaries. Of course, Muslims have contributed their share of violence in this world, but I cannot express strongly enough how this unrelieved portrayal of an entire community as aggressively violent runs contrary to the reality and to the most fundamental values and teachings of the faith. The problem with these stereotypes and caricatures is that objectivity and truth are the earliest casualties in this business of creating stereotypes. But mutual fear and distrust are among its first products. And this provides the backdrop against which we have to address the subject at hand. At the present time, indeed, of historic changes in Europe, it is important that all its inhabitants feel that they are accepted in equality and security. This particularly at a time when Islam is in the midst of the West as much as the West is in the midst of Islam, in the midst of Muslims. This applies not only to the growing number of Muslim immigrants, Asian and British, Turks in Germany, North Africans in France, but also to the growing number of native Europeans turning to Islam, sometimes described as WASP Muslims. Understanding this complex Muslim population is no longer a matter of understanding something far afield. It is a matter of knowing and understanding one's next-door neighbor. Eventually, this must lead to a redefinition of the meaning of the European identity and of its relationship with the outside world. The addition of Islam to the European Judeo-Christian heritage requires us in modern Europe to seek to understand and extend the Abrahamic tradition. Edward Mortimer ably summarizes the situation, and I quote, various factors are pushing Europe to define itself in terms not perhaps of Christian belief, but certainly of Christian heritage, and to emphasize as sharply as possible the distinction and the frontier between itself and the world of Islam. This may be unavoidable. It may in some respects even be desirable. But the implications need to be considered very carefully. If the price to be paid is to make every Muslim resident in the European community feel that he or she is at best a tolerated alien, then that price is certainly too high. A more constructive and harmonious way to define Europe needs to be found. It is against this background that I turn to Muslims in the West in order to consider how they can contribute to a resolution of these dilemmas. A predominantly secular Western society places a range of pressures upon its Muslim members. The pressures on family life, the challenge to notions of modesty and shame and honor, the predominance of materialistic values and consumerism, the decline in spiritual values, the encounter between faith and skepticism, and the manifestation of trends which denigrate expressions of personal religiosity, let alone collective worship so central to Islam. Added to this is the problem that too few Muslims in the West possess the competence to overcome or even to articulate an informed and proper response to these difficulties. Sadly, such situations give rise to feelings of helplessness and frustration, and often to anger, bitterness, and extremism. Now, it is the combination of these pressures and the lack of understanding for the concerns and viewpoints which causes some Muslims increasingly to withdraw into themselves. The more they retreat into a protective cocoon or ghetto, the more they become marginalized within society and the more receptive they are to those who would have them seek solutions through their own exclusively sectarian political organizations. It becomes a vicious circle that does disservice to Muslims themselves and to the larger society of which they are part. The price paid for this situation is the fundamentally important debates of our time on debates on freedom, distributive justice, equality before the law, individual and social morality, insufficiently incorporate a proper appreciation of the values of both Muslim and Western experience. Now, this situation cannot be changed if Muslims stay or are kept on the sidelines rather than engage in mainstream discussion and resolution of matters of concern to everybody. They have a duty to make an important moral and ethical contribution to these debates of our times, and I have no doubt that if they were to do so, they will find many of other faiths and no faith as partners in this. But in order to make this contribution, Muslims must liberate themselves from the very things that they find objectionable in others. But here comes the catch. For some Muslims, the shock of their encounter with modern Western life has been a reawakening of interest and a rediscovery of the totality of Islam. For others, the encounter has prompted a more apologetic reaction in which they serve to demonstrate that this or that element in Islam corresponds to whatever is currently fashionable in Western society. And yet Muslims themselves imperfectly understand the bases and values of Western society. And as a result, Muslim critiques, one may say, are often frequently superficial, ill-informed and focused on the symptoms rather than the causes of the malaise. Now, the major task, I believe, for Muslims in the West lies in the field of education. There is a dichotomy between home education and school education. And many people have written on that, including many in the American university systems, Fazlur Rahman's work, I think of, Sayyid Hussein Nasr and others. And despite widespread and deep consciousness of this division, all efforts to achieve a genuine integration so far have been largely unfruitful. And such disillusion leads to some becoming attracted to Western values, but others equally being repulsed. So the urgent need is for Muslims to develop an understanding but independent attitude towards Western culture, which provides them with the ability to make their own authentic contribution. Too often, there is the substitution of cliché-mongering for serious intellectual endeavor. And such circumstances encourage the exploitation of Islam for short-term social or political purposes, focused on the most obvious shortcomings in society and those most easily criticized. Few have the courage, indeed, the necessary qualifications to engage in any serious discourse about what the basic challenges are. There are simply too few Muslims who are qualified to be able to engage in a debate with the West with that same, as has been said by others, with the spiritual and with the same spiritual and intellectual force, which is the very basis of the challenge with which the West encounters Muslim societies. Now, the resolution of the dilemmas facing Muslims in the West therefore requires both a serious and responsible reassessment of the true meaning of Islam by the West itself, and as important, a major effort by Muslims to cooperate fully and positively in that task. To do so, it is imperative that Muslims be clear about the exact nature of the present challenge. And, as I indicated earlier, there are not many who are aware of that. There are two basic challenges. One is the challenge posed to Muslims by the materialistic values of modern Western civilization. The other originates in the inertia and conservatism of Muslims themselves. And Muslims in the West, therefore, must decide what exactly needs to be conserved, what is fundamentally Islamic, and what is the product of custom or culture. Muslims must answer these questions if they are to prepare themselves for the much greater challenge posed by modern civilization. Some might say, therefore, that the phrase "being British, feeling Muslim" suggests at the least a conundrum or confusion in loyalties, and at worst, a contradiction. The implication is either that this national identity, being British, excludes a commitment to Islam, feeling Muslim, or the other way around, that if you have a commitment to Islam, if you feel Muslim, you can't be, or at least have a problem being British. It would be easy to pick away at the phrase in order to show up its shortcomings. Imagine having to adapt it for those British men or women who have converted to Islam. But it is a useful phrase nevertheless. It highlights the fact that in important ways, national identity tends to be exclusive. But there seems to be no obvious reasons why the exclusiveness of national identity should become associated with possessive, aggressive, pride, or hateful contempt for those who are on the wrong side of the same border. As I'm sure those of you who study European history would recognize, that national identity acquired possessive and aggressive traits from the mid-18th to the mid-20th centuries. Since that time, for most Western Europeans, the primary marker of collective identity and the primary focus of political loyalty has been their nationality. This process coincided conveniently with the age of European expansion overseas. Pride in being, for example, British or French, slipped easily into and rested comfortably with feelings of racial or cultural exceptionalism and sometimes even superiority. Within given borders, national pride was supported by a parallel development in rights of citizenship, which made loyalty to the state relatively easy. These rights of citizenship cover three broad areas: civil rights, political rights, and social rights. So citizenship thus evolved through the establishment of legal and institutional frameworks which enabled individuals to participate in society. The citizens had a stake, a say, rights, and responsibilities. Those who, for whatever reason, on whatever grounds of mistrust and suspicion, are not allowed or allowed to participate in society, cannot function as citizens. Now, it is worth noting that progress in citizenship was not necessarily won at the expense of religious life or religious identity. This may not be an important issue in the United States because of the separation of church and here, but in Europe it is. Alongside the law of the land, the sovereign law, there remained the church. Citizenship was vigorously individualistic and aimed at achieving the proper institutional environment for freedom of enterprise. To the extent that citizenship was an argument against inherited wealth and privilege, it could also become an argument against inherited authority generally, and of course religious authority was a special case. Now, I touch upon this because this question is important, especially from the viewpoint of a Muslim, reflecting upon what sort of fit is possible between being Muslim and being British. I would argue that although one in theory can draw a clear line from the progress of citizenship to the present decline in habits of religious contemplation and prayer in Britain, in practice, that is in history, there is no such clear line. That decline has to do with other factors, particularly in patterns of work and mobility, mass production, consumption and entertainment, which are having a negative impact on the quality of citizenship as well as on religious observance. Now, given that there is no inherent or necessary contradiction between the practice of citizenship in Britain and a committed religious life, and as I said, this is not an issue in the United States, but in Europe it is, because people see of themselves as more secular society, it seems to me that any Muslim who is not a fanatic could look with admiration at British citizenship. And indeed, if he or she already has it, with gratitude. Whereas the values of the citizenship are inclusive and universal in their moral appeal, the values of national identity are temperamentally exclusive and can become, in times of crisis, narrow, aggressive, and vulgar. Again, for a country like the United States, which is based on the idea of citizenship, this may not be something important, but for Europe, it is very important. Now, it is a part of British self-image that the British are a tolerant nation, a tolerant society. Over the centuries, the British have given asylum to political refugees and welcomed immigrants, most famously the Protestants exiled from France and integrated with them, and the nation is the richer for it. All that is true, but prior to the 1960s and 70s, the only substantial immigration to Britain was primarily from within Europe and preceded the full achievement of citizenship rights. So people who were already there struggled for the citizenship rights, and they did not come into something which had already been won. Post-war immigrants, however, were not primarily from within Europe, but from the former colonies in the so-called Third World. Moreover, they entered into full citizenship without having had a part in the evolution of that status. The new immigrants were, without always being mistreated, of course, often looked down on. Most of them moved, as immigrants always do, into the poorer areas of town, were considered an embarrassment and therefore an economic cost to the white neighbors, who then moved out if they could. This led within a short time, within a decade or two, to distinct enclaves within neighborhoods, and thence with growth in numbers to substantially segregated neighborhoods, Bradford, Burnley, Oldham, etc., which in recent times have suffered from communal rioting. And since poverty concentrates as well as wealth, this adds another layer of problems, which in a sense deepen and darken the segregation that had taken place. Now, for immigrants overall, the situation got better during the 1980s and 90s as they learned to adjust and as the host community recognized and struggled against its prejudices. Those prejudices, as I indicated earlier, run very deep. The host community had not been prepared to receive as equal citizens in their own midst large numbers of formerly dependent colonized peoples. But it would be absurdly unjust to claim that no progress has been made in the containment and steady weakening of those prejudices. And yet, it would also be wrong to be complacent and assume no further effort is needed. So the arrival of immigrants from the Commonwealth, their settlement and growth in numbers, have changed the composition of the population of Britain. But Britain has not consequently reimagined its historical narrative, nor has it started seeing that history in new perspectives, which can put an unfamiliar value on famous and familiar events. It is simply a fact that for historical and religious reasons, some of Europe's oldest, deepest, and most irrational prejudices run against the Islamic world, and therefore more acutely and more unpleasantly than for any other group of immigrants, every crisis brings the background noise of national identity abruptly to the foreground. And once again, international events, such as the tragedy of September 11th, have put the Islamic world under the spotlight. Now, it is greatly to the credit of the governments of the United Kingdom and indeed of the United States that they moved quickly after 9/11 to voice a clear distinction between Islam and terrorism. The intention of these public pronouncements was to prevent a climate of fear and resentment from taking hold. And to some extent, this effort has succeeded. In today's Elizabethan England, the Muslims are not viewed with the same suspicion as Catholics were in the England of Elizabeth I. Most Muslims are keeping their heads and voices down, as it were. The few who take to the streets or find spots on the TV to support declared enemies of the state abroad and perhaps threaten direct action within are declared and recognized as small minorities. But nevertheless, in the post-9/11 climate, it has been possible to affirm attitudes and voice anti-Muslim sentiments which we had hoped were fading. Even self-professedly liberal-minded commentators have argued against the fundamental incompatibility between Islamic and British values and the threat to our way of life. In an article in the Spectator magazine, for instance, one commentator said that the Muslim presence has caused convulsions in Europe, referring to the rise of the right-wing nationalist parties. Now, the same article said cultural differences are all very well and to be respected, but where there is a conflict, the values of the majority must win. Must was the word used. But what values are these that the majority cherishes and the Muslims oppose? The one value Muslims cannot oppose is the right of free and equal citizens to associate, to worship, to educate their children in the way of life, and to argue a point of view, political or otherwise, which the majority does not at any given moment hold. If it were true that the majority must win, in practice, of course, the majority always wins, but if it were true that the majority must win, we would have to believe that the majority is always right. And almost invariably, people who take this line mean that the majority to which they belong is always right. Now, in practice, Muslim presence in Britain, or for that matter in Europe more generally, has so far meant little more to the majority communities than a wider range of consumer goods and services, especially cuisine, from which they can all choose. Multiculturalism, interestedness in other cultures, can be a sort of a chic, if you like, a must-have attitude. But it should be, and is, I would suggest to you, more and better than this. Multiculturalism coincides with important economic, technological, and political changes. Modern communications and transport mean that immigrants do not get completely cut off from communities of origin. Local assimilation is simply not necessary. Multiculturalism, plurality, and diversity correspond to real, important, and irreversible changes in the ways that people in the modern world live their lives. These changes require corresponding adaptations in our attitudes and institutions, so that relations between the complex communities within cities and nations can be peaceful, stable, and productive. To say it in the form of a slogan, perhaps, we need more and better tolerance. Now, as I noted earlier, it is a part of the British self-image that we are a tolerant society. Commentators often point to modern political systems and structures as being tolerant of religious and cultural diversity, and also point out that with considerable grounds for doing so, that Islamic societies do not have the same systems and structures and are therefore not tolerant. But how in the daily round do Muslims experience that tolerance? Consider the fact that in certain of our urban centers, parents in the majority community were quite happy to see their children mixing in schools with black children or with Muslim children. But as the number, as the proportion of these black children and Muslim children grew, the non-Muslim white parents decided to withdraw their children from these schools. Is tolerance the right word to use? I think indifference would be more apt, provided we do not make the mistake of thinking that indifference is necessarily something bad. I mean, on the contrary, I would say indifference can be a good. By indifference, I mean a relationship between parties wherein there is a reciprocated right of non-interference, of letting be. If the courts of law, if the state and all its officers afford to me rights and protections set against duties and obligations, indifferently as to my race or religion, then the law courts and the state are being positively and attractively indifferent. This indifference can and perhaps should be based on non-religious grounds. It is based upon the state according the same rights because it wants the same loyalty from all its citizens, regardless of denominational or other identity. For the most part, the guarantor of citizenship rights is the sovereign state. Now, how does that impact upon Muslims in Britain? Where do they fit in what is their future. Assuming xenophobia or Islamophobia do not win all the votes, Muslims will be in Britain to stay. It follows that they must be allowed and that they must learn to participate in the social, political life of the national entity, of which they are an integral part. They cannot be above the law or beyond the law. They should be too obvious, that is too obvious a thing to say, but it needs saying if only to make two important points. The first is that the demands of political correctness can inhibit debate where debate is clearly needed. For example, for fear of being thought to criticize cultural practice of arranged marriage, people are chary of distinguishing that practice from forced marriage. This is a distinction that really needs making. The second point, for instance, is that the law of the land should be promoted as such, as the law for all the people. For all the people, rather than for any particular section. So, the law applies within the jurisdiction of a particular country to all its citizens. It should not be written specifically for any one section of the society. And if that is done, then of course it makes people uncomfortable, or it reduces the citizens' rights or competences vis-a-vis other minorities or the majority. Now, for historical reasons not relevant to dwell on here, Muslim immigrants, by and large, as with immigrants from most third world countries, have little experience of civil or political association, separate from association by family and clan or immediate neighborhood, and separate from denominational association. But they are learning, and the process should be assisted, not prevented. The rise in the number of Muslim local councillors and MPs, the increase in the number of Muslims participating in such causes as the anti-globalization or anti-war movements, in pro-third world and pro-human rights campaigns, should be welcomed, not feared. Encouraging Islamic schools, for instance, in the pattern of Catholic schools, would give the Muslims a stake in the society, an avenue of participation in the institutional framework from which they are so often excluded. It ought to be possible to encourage Muslim women's groups, which have mushroomed in recent years to serve the needs of victims of particular crises, to play an important role. And a welcome side effect of such groups is that the acceptance of such causes by the Muslim community as a whole enables the women to gain a foothold in public life, to acquire and practice habits of citizenship, which the majority community takes for granted, and to do so without provoking intolerable strains within own families and communities. So adaptiveness by professionals in the health and social services and in policing attitudes and methods, which takes account of cultural sensitivities and priorities, is especially praiseworthy. It will help the minorities to acquire a place and a stake in the way society and state function and make it easier for them to enter into these professions. And all this is happening in Britain. Now, the majority of Muslims would agree that the goal of integration is desirable, but they might disagree amongst themselves and with the majority about what integration means. Integration is a collective goal or ideal which will serve us best if we do not overdefine it at the beginning. The pragmatic attitude is to aim at allowing and enabling the Muslims to participate in society and state in the diverse ways and at the diverse levels in which the majority do so without having to think about. To that end, it is important and perhaps necessary to encourage competence, for instance, in the English language, which has now become one of the main issues that the government has recently been pushing. But to make other conditions as a test for citizenship, in a sense, would, apart from being somewhat at variance with, say, the political temperament of the country, might even be counterproductive insofar as it is bound to function and feel like a return to monocultural, monoethnic nationhood, which is a thing of the past. So being British, feeling Muslim, need not be the conundrum or contradiction of loyalties it is feared to be. If both the being British and having a commitment to Islam are allowed to evolve, as they must evolve, in the emerging context of complex post-national identities. The world is changing. Indeed, it has changed. And it is high time that we let our categories of self-image grow with those changes. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with European Studies at Boston University. Tonight's lecture was titled Being British, Feeling Muslim. It was given by Farhan Nizami, director of the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, Prince of Wales Fellow in the Study of the Islamic World, Magdalen College, Oxford. Opening remarks were by Augustus Richard Norton, professor of International Relations and Anthropology at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.